Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
One of my favorite people, favorite reporters, Tyson Alger. The I-5 Corridor is the name of his publication. He's doing something cool this month. No paywall on any of his posts. He's joining us now. Happy spring. Is it spring? What do we call it? Like happy spring fever? I don't know if we say that. That might be a weird thing to say to someone. How are you doing, man?
Well, I'm good. Happy spring fever back to you, John. I appreciate you having me on today.
Oh, that's my first happy spring fever anyone's ever given me. let me ask you this. I was talking about this in the last segment. Tara Vanderveer hangs it up at Stanford. You know, she's out after so many years. I wonder if we're going to see coaches stay at one place for any length of time. Do you get a sense that that has changed in this era?
I think you'll have certain cases or coaches who might be an outlier, but I don't think that most people are going to have careers like that anymore. I mean, we're going on year three here in Eugene with Dan Lanning, and that feels like it's been a while, you know, and that's just because at this point, that's just kind of the life cycle of coaches in sports. And for somebody to not only, you know, be able to have the success that she did at Stanford, but also like just the longevity. I just think college sports is way too fluid of a situation these days to expect anybody to have that sort of continuity and career anymore.
Dan Lanning comes out, says the grass isn't greener. I'm at Oregon. Do you think he's a guy that could be a 15 or 20 year coach at one place, or is he just is it a 5 or 7 year thing in your mind?
Boy, 15, 20 years in this day and age, that's hard to predict how anything's going to be in that. But I do think that Lanning is in a case where, you know, he's a competitive guy who wants to win, who wants to be in the best situation for himself. But that also right now is kind of shaping up to be where Oregon's at. I mean, they're changing conferences. They have a loaded roster. You know, their recruiting classes have been as good as almost anybody in the country. And they're one of the few schools that does have the NIL thing figured out. And so, yeah, you know, if you choose not to believe that Dan Lanning absolutely loves Eugene and, you know, is calls himself an Oregonian at this point, at least believe the fact that he's a smart coach who knows a good situation. And right now I don't see him finding anything that's better outside of Eugene for quite some time.
You had a profile on Rashad Samples, 29-year-old, new running backs coach at Oregon. What did you learn about him in reporting and telling his story today?
I learned that he's another young coach. He's 29 years old, but he's kind of proven himself for a very long time. He grew up in the Dallas area. His dad is a legendary high school football coach there, has won the last two 6A state championship games down in Texas. And so he grew up in that household, and he grew up under very stern leadership and coaching from his dad. He said he didn't flip the switch when you got home. It was Rashad's friends weren't hearing back from him, it's because his dad took his phone away because he wasn't catching enough passes in practice. So he grew up under a lot of discipline. He had some injuries that derailed his own playing career, but, you know, just being able to kind of get into coaching and to build some confidence, he talked a lot about it, just like having proof of concept and being able to like believe in yourself being a big part of his career. And so, yeah, the Ducks got another young one, but, you know, Kenny Dillingham is sure throwing a lot of praise at him. He said that he's someday going to be the youngest coach in college football, and Dillingham would know a lot about that because currently he is the youngest coach in Power 5 football.
I'm looking at Samples, and he's 29. He's coached in the NFL. He's coached in the Big 12 and the Pac-12, and, you know, he's been a coach since he was 26, okay, young guy. But am I the only one who's going, gosh, Dan Lanning's a young head coach? Tosh Lapoy, relatively young and inexperienced on the defensive side. Will Stein, the offensive coordinator, looks like he's right out of high school. I mean, like, you got some young guys on this staff. Do they need some old ideas in the room, or is this just a new world?
I think it's just kind of the new world at this point. You know, we've seen the sport shift so much to talent acquisition. And if you're going to be a top-level recruiter, and that's what Samples has shown so far that he is you just have to have the energy and drive for that. And, you know, a big part of picking him up, too, is his connections in the Dallas area and in the Texas area. That's a state that Oregon has been dipping its toes in the recruiting field lately. And it's obviously a massive area for Oregon to go into and bring players out of. You know, we're used to seeing Oregon have rosters populated with players out of Arizona, out of California, but Texas is obviously a monster out there. And so if you can get a running backs coach who, you know, don't get me wrong, running backs coaches are important, but, you know, if you can get a guy that can bring you in some really good guys, I think you're probably willing to have that guy be a little bit younger than maybe, you know, one of your coordinators or something like that.
Dylan Gabriel, Dante Moore. I am fascinated by the young QB / veteran QB that Oregon has in that room. How's that going to shake out in the spring and maybe throughout the season as those guys are competing for opportunity?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a nice separation between these two guys just because of what Gabriel has done in his career. I mean, he comes to Oregon with a better pedigree than Bo Nix ever did, and Bo Nix leaves Eugene as one of the better quarterbacks to play here. So, you know, I don't think there's a whole lot of question about whether or not Gabriel can do it, because we've seen, frankly, a lot of it. And I think that probably takes a little bit of the pressure off of Moore, too, because, you know, the way it's kind of set up is he can come in here, he can learn, he can be a very, very, very competent backup if Gabriel happens to get hurt. But then it's like, this is his baby, this is his team next year. So I don't think that there's maybe the pressure that was on him last year as a five-star true freshman that came into UCLA camp and, you know, was expected to come and win the job right away and improve your ranking. You know, at Oregon, he can kind of grow and you know, learn from a guy who has played a lot of really good football. And, you know, I hate to say plug and play with Nix to Gabriel, but if you're looking for somebody who is going to be able to run an offense and do it in a way where you can take advantage of the skilled players that you have, like Oregon does, I think Gabriel slots right in, and I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of adjustment period to get this season going. I think the Ducks are going to be able to come out running.
You can read Tyson Alger at i5corridor.com, where it is a toll-free month, meaning no paywall. Tyson, the biggest question for Oregon this spring, what do you need to know before the games start, before fall camp starts?
That's a good question, John, because this is a rare spring where you are replacing a quarterback, but like we just said, we know the stability of that position. I think just looking on defense, I think this is where this team can take the largest step forward. You did bring in a lot of new pieces, transfers on the defensive line and at quarterback, but this is a very, very, very good linebacking core. And I just really want to kind of continue to hear throughout the spring that those guys between like Jeffrey Bossa, Justin Jacobs, and the edge players like Mateo Uliagalelei, I really think that we're going to start to see that group emerge as like the unit of this defense. And, you know, I guess that's not so much of the question, is that I'm just looking for that next step and kind of the evolution of Tashu Boy's defense here.
I am, I keep saying the same thing. Like last year at this time, I said, gosh, I need to see the defense take a step forward. I need to see the defense have an identity. And I kind of finished the year saying, okay, that was a nice step, but it was kind of a half step or a three-quarter step. I need to see another one. I don't know if I'm being greedy or not. Maybe I'm being too critical of the team and nitpicking, but I need to see that. And then I need to see them win a big game this season. Like, you know, yeah, the 0-3 record against Washington, losing one of the two Civil War games. It's kind of just, it's in the back of my head as they're going to run into Ohio State and some Big Ten teams that will not be forgiving.
Yeah, and I think that's why this is such a tough spring, is because, you know, they're going to look really good this spring, and we're going to hear about how Gabriel is just as good as Nix, or about how Jordan James is really running with it, taking the ball from Bucky Irving. But at the end of the day, like, we're not really going to know what we really need to think about this team until it's October, November, and you're late in the fourth quarter and it's high pressure situations. Because outside of that, Oregon was excellent last year. It was just in several key spots they weren't able to flip the switch. And I don't know if that's something that you can learn in spring, or if that's something that you can start building in spring, but it's certainly something that we're not going to know until much, much later from now.
I have a hard time because of the first Washington game and the way that Dan Lanning's strategy, not to kick the field goal, he goes for it three times, and I kind of like that as the Oregon identity, but would have loved to have seen, you know, nothing wrong with a field goal, nothing wrong with taking 3 points. Like, do you put the 0-3 against Washington on the roster, on Lanning's relative inexperience, on some combination of it, or does that stuff just happen in football, that maybe Washington was further along kind of as an evolved program when Lanning came on the scene?
I think it was a little bit of that. You know, I don't know if Lanning's a 15-year head coach, if how differently he calls those plays. That being said, you got to put some of it on the players, especially if you like look at that Pac-12 championship game where Oregon started out so slow. It kind of felt like Bo Nix was in a bit of a funk before they loosened up. But then also, like, Michael Penix was really good, John. So was Rome Odunze. Like, that was – I've watched a fair amount of football in this region for the last 12, 13 years, and that connection is as good as I've ever seen. And I think sometimes you can be really good and you're just beat by somebody who's really, really, really good. And I think a little bit of that was Oregon and Washington the last 2 years.
Tyson Alger with us, I-5 Corridor. You've been doing a lot of coverage of the Timbers. You know, a lot of our listeners are tuned in with that franchise. State of the Union right now. What kind of season will this be for the Timbers?
Is this when I can switch into my accent? I've been working on my my British accent. No, we're not quite ready there yet. The Timbers are in an interesting spot because they finally have gotten their roster. They signed Jonathan Rodriguez. He's their big striker that they got from Mexico, team that can score a whole lot of goals. But through the first set of adversity that they've gone through, the Phil Neville era where they lost 3 consecutive games, they were allowing a ton of goals. And it really looked like it was heading that way again this weekend when they went and came all the way back to tie that game. Neville afterwards was pretty darn ticked, and it's fascinating going from covering colleges where coaches kind of take the blame a little bit more and don't necessarily call out players as much, to go to the professional atmosphere where Neville was, you know, his post game quotes were, "I was trying to decide whether or not these guys were going to be Portland Timbers in the future." And it's kind of fascinating to just kind of be in different types of press conferences right now.
I talked in the last segment about my coaches, meaning the coaches, you know, we always say, hey, this is my broadcaster, and people will bring up like Dave Niehaus or Bill Shonley. That was my broadcaster, or their favorite player. They'll talk about the player that, you know, Bill Walton or whoever it is. As a coach, like Bill Walsh was one of my coaches because I grew up rooting for the Niners. And then, you know, Jack Elway was the coach at San Jose State, and I used to go to games when I was 9 or 10 years old. So that guy was my coach. Who's Tyson Alger's coach?
It was Lou Piniella for me. I grew up a big Mariners fan in the 90s, and then, you know, we moved to Alaska, and there's not a whole lot of professional coaches up there that you guys would recognize anyways. And so kind of watching the fiery Piniella and the kind of the miracle of those 95 Mariners, that was definitely the coach that I attached to from a professional level. But if we want to get really in the weeds here, my high school hockey coach, Steve McSwain, wouldn't be here today without that guy. Just one of those guys who probably put in, you know, 30 extra hours a week coaching. He used to play in the league. He got a whole bunch of concussions and ended up running this rink in Palmer, Alaska. And, you know, it was anytime we wanted to get on the ice, he'd get on the ice with us and start running drills. And it was so funny because he was a germaphobe too, which is funny for a former pro hockey player. So he would write all these drills down on this whiteboard, and because he had been hit in the head so many times, he would screw it up all the time, and so he would never wipe it off because he was a germaphobe. So we'd start doing these drills, and he'd have the whiteboard, and it's just completely covered in marker. And he's like, "All right, who's going to be going first?" And it's like, everyone's kind of looking around, and I was the captain, and so it's like, "I'll go," and I more often than not screwed it up, but it's just I remember every single one of the coaches that I had growing up, and I think that's kind of the special connection that when we talk about coaches now, there's a lot of negative around, you know, the professional and the money and everything. But I think we all know deep down, like, what the true meaning and character of one of those coaches really is, and it's special for all of us.
Yeah, you can help us with something on this show because you're a guy who lived in Alaska, grew up in Alaska. I was watching True Detective, Night Country,
okay,
and it's set in this fictional Alaskan town called Ennis, supposedly 150 miles north of the Arctic Circle. Now, the show opens on December 17th, which we're told is an important date because it's the last sunset of the year, and then it's just dark. Is that really how it is in Alaska? Or give us kind of, because of where Alaska is on the globe, what that long night or long summer looks like.
Well, the first mess up of that show is I didn't see any, like, home of Tyson Alger billboards. And
yes,
believe me, those are all over the state. Where I grew up, we didn't quite have, like, the full, like, you don't see any sun. You know, in December, it would be the sun probably comes up around 9:30, and it's going down around 2:30, 3 o'clock. So you'd go to school in the dark, and you'd come back in the dark. But if you go up where that show was supposedly set, yeah, it's definitely about a month without sun. And you go into the schools, and all the kids have to do, like, light therapy and all this other stuff. But it's a wild world. We would go play some hockey tournaments up there, and the state rule for outdoor games was you'd have to play if it was warmer than 20 below. And we played a couple games at 19 below zero, and that was not very fun.
So they call it the polar night. And, you know, and I don't know psychologically how good that would be. I would ask those people, like, whose idea was it to live here? Like, I don't get it.
Believe me, as a high schooler in Alaska with parents who had the ability to live in any other state, I asked them that quite often. But, you know, you get a little bit older and you begin to appreciate some other things about, you know, a place. Like, I still love going back and visiting Alaska, but, you know, the college football isn't so great up there. So I'm happy where I ended up.
Northern Alaska does not sound interesting to me. All right. Tyson Alger, i5corridor.com. Give him an opportunity. Check out his work. Tyson, thank you, man.
Hey, thanks, John.
There he goes. Barrow, Alaska is the northernmost village in the state. Stephen, do not look this up. In the heart of winter, they have what's called a polar night, meaning for more than one day, more than 24 hours, there's no daylight. How long is the longest polar night in Barrow, Alaska? Trivia question. Northernmost village in the state of Alaska. Just take a stab.
I'm going to go with, like, 4 days.
All right. There is no daylight in the heart of winter for 64 straight days.
Oh, jeez.
No, thank you. Sun never goes above the horizon, and it's 350 miles north of the Arctic Circle. And for weeks at a time, the only visible sunlight is a faint twilight in the horizon. I got to know, do we have a listener in Barrow, Alaska, who can call into the show, or somebody who's lived there, and tell us what that is like? Now, I've been places where you have long summer days, including, I actually think, like, in our summer here, we get long days, and I have friends that'll visit, and they'll be like, it's still light out, it's like almost 9 o'clock, like, when does the sun goes down? Or they'll look around and say, gosh, your days are so long, if they're visiting from other parts of the country, and it doesn't really occur to me, right? But I would have to think after, like, 60, 62 days of darkness, you'd be like, you know, I haven't seen the sun in a while. All right, leave it here. You got the BFT statewide.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.